Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 36. College Closed and Church Dissolved. For some time before Mrs. Eddy left for Chicago, serious trouble had been developing among her followers in Boston. This trouble had its origin in two main tendencies, both present from the first, which were to maintain themselves in various forms as thorns in the flesh of the movement, right up to the time of Mrs. Eddy's passing beyond. The first of these was the tendency of certain of her students and followers to adulterate her teaching by the introduction of all manner of strange doctrine. And the second was sycophancy, and its inevitable repercussion in its most rabid form. Richard Kennedy going out frankly as a dissident in 1872, and George Berry, after years of abject devotion, bringing suit against his patron and teacher to recover compensation for his every act of service, are typical instances of both tendencies, and they were to be duplicated again and again. In the early days of 1888, the great problem confronting Mrs. Eddy was the protection of her teaching against adulteration by her students and misrepresentation by her enemies. Of these, the former was by far the most dangerous, and she rightly so regarded it. For several years, as has been seen, Julius Dresser had been urging the claims of Quimby to be the real discoverer of Mrs. Eddy's teaching, or rather of what he conceived Mrs. Eddy's teaching ought to be. There was, of course, a curious inconsistency in his position. On the one hand, the more fully he developed his concept of what Quimby actually taught, the more indignant he became over Mrs. Eddy's glaring departure from that teaching, and at the same time, the more insistent was he that she was a plagiarist of the worst type. In 1887, Julius Dresser had published his book, The True History of Mental Science and the Foundations for What Came to Be Called the New Thought Movement, as it exists today, were being laid. Not a few of Mrs. Eddy's students were attracted by restatements and variations of Quimby's teaching. The appeal to manipulation, mental and physical, which underlay it, was much more readily comprehended by some mentalities than the appeal to spiritual law, which was the basis of Mrs. Eddy's doctrine. Quimbyism would inevitably appear to them much more rational and simple. It put forward no such revolutionary ideas as that involved in denying the sure enough isness, as one critic put it, of matter and the material creation, while it preserved at all times intact the nexus with matter. In other words, it was easy to believe that mind could influence the body, so long as there was some outward means provided by which the contact could be effected, even if it were only the making of passes with the hands or the manipulation of the head with wet fingers. Even more misleading, because much more subtle than the teaching of Quimby, as adapted by Dresser, was the adaptation of Christian Science to the Quimby doctrine. Quimbyism was always much more of a philosophy or a method of medicine than a religion, and as a consequence, fell short in its appeal to many people. This shortcoming, it was the objective of the ever-recurring new and improved system of mental healing to make good. One of the main attractions of all such teaching to the less fervid among Mrs. Eddy's followers was the freedom it seemed to offer the individual student. The suggestion that there was more than one way, that Christian Science was all right, but something else might be discovered that was just as good, if not better, had a tremendous appeal, especially to those who resented the stern discipline meted out by Mrs. Eddy in her insistence that it was no more possible to deviate by a hair's breadth from the principle of Christian Science and succeed in its demonstration than it was to deviate from the principle of mathematics and expect to solve its problems. Mrs. Eddy was uncompromising in the matter. Having seen so much suffering from quackery, she wrote in her book, Science and Health, the author desires to keep it out of Christian Science. The two-edged sword of truth must turn in every direction to guard the tree of life. And so, as the danger increased, the Christian Scientist Association, under her direction, passed a series of resolutions, each one more drastic than the last, calculated to curb this tendency to go after other gods. Members of the association were forbidden to use any other books as textbooks than Science and Health and the Bible. Later on, they were forbidden to meet in small groups to discuss Christian Science unless all members of the association were invited to attend. In spite of everything, however, the unrest and fermentation continued, and Mrs. Eddy knew when she set out for Chicago that she was leaving behind her, in Boston, a situation very much like that which had confronted her in Lynn 7 years before. A typical instance of such deviating doctrine may be seen in the teaching of the Reverend Warren F. Evans, which about that time was attracting much attention. Dr. Evans never was a student of Mrs. Eddy. Neither did he, as far as can be gathered, ever claim that he had evolved a rival system. Indeed, he seems to have been one of the earliest exponents of pure Quimbyism, having been treated by Quimby in 1863. And as early as 1869, writing a book on the subject. His history was an interesting and significant one. Born in Rockingham, Vermont, in 1817, he was educated at Chester Academy, Middlebury College, and Dartmouth. Later, he received a diploma which entitled him to the degree of M.D. from a chartered board of physicians of the eclectic school. He left Dartmouth before he had finished his course there and entered the ministry of the Methodist Episcopal Church, and for some 20 years held charges in various towns in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Always somewhat frail, in the latter years of his ministry, he suffered from persistent ill health. This was in the early 60s of last century, when, as has been seen, all manner of excursions were being made into the occult and the mystic in the simplest meanings of those words. Spiritualism, mesmerism, electromagnetism, and so forth. While great impetus was given to the more spiritual and mystic teaching of Emanuel Swedenborg. And so, in these years of broken health, Evans began the study of the works of Swedenborg, and came to believe strongly in the possibility of curing physical disease through the power of living faith. About the year 1863, Evans went to Quimby for treatment. It was just a year after Mrs. Eddy's first meeting with him, and like her, Evans seems to have been convinced that he had found the truth for which he had long been seeking. The difference between the reaction of the two was, however, fundamental. For whereas Mary Patterson manifestly read into the Quimby doctrine views of a radically different kind, later to appear in Christian Science, Evans seems to have grasped Quimbyism more nearly as Quimby taught it than Dresser or anyone else. After a second visit to Portland, he told Quimby that he felt sure he could practice his teaching. And on receiving cordial encouragement from the always generous little doctor, he returned to his home at Claremont, New Hampshire, and at once began to practice. He later set up a kind of mind cure sanatorium known as the Evans Home at Salisbury, Massachusetts, and in the latter years of his life devoted himself to writing books on the subject of mental healing. It is true, he surrounds it all with an atmosphere of religion and faith. To Dresser and Evans were added several other minor schools. Indeed, one of the causes of unrest among Mrs. Eddy's students was the temptation the situation presented to many of them to go out and found a school of their own, it would appear. This was not the only reason for unrest in this medley of personalities which constituted her following. About this time, dissension from another direction was to shake the young movement to its very foundations. It happened in the spring of 1888. Mrs. Abby H. Corner, one of Mrs. Eddy's students in West Medford, Massachusetts, attended her own daughter in childbirth, and that both the mother and the child died. An outraged community saw to it that Mrs. Corner was indicted for murder, seeing that she did not have medical attention for her daughter, and the case was given enormous publicity in the papers. It was by no means unheard of for Christian Scientists to be dragged before the courts in those days, charged by their religious and medical opponents with everything from practicing medicine without a license to manslaughter. In the majority of such instances, the scientists won out, establishing their constitutional rights of freedom of religious practice and free choice in the method of treatment to be followed. But this case was to have greater repercussions than any of the others. Not a few in the Christian Scientist Association looked upon the situation as a test of their religion and called for a rallying to the support of their persecuted colleague at a special meeting. Although invited, Mrs. Eddy did not attend, and more disquieting still, the following letter appeared in the Boston Herald under date of April 29th over the signature of the Committee on Publication, Christian Scientist Association. The lamentable case reported from West Medford of the death of a mother and her infant at childbirth should forever put a stop to quackery. There has been but one side of this case presented by the newspapers. We wait to hear from the other side, trusting that attenuating circumstances will be brought to light. Mrs. Abby H. Corner never entered the obstetrics class at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. She was not fitted at this institute for an accoucheur, had attended but one term, and four terms, including 3 years of successful practice by the student, are required to complete the college course. Not only had the committee no knowledge of this letter before it was published, but the college had no more than 3, not 4, terms. Practitioners did not specialize in their treatment of diseases and disorders, and all had been handling cases of every type without a 3 years apprenticeship. Such was the position of affairs when 36 members decided to withdraw. But a formidable obstacle stood in their way. There was, it will be remembered, the stipulation in the organization bylaws that anyone who wished to resign his membership was guilty of immorality and should be publicly so branded. They were well aware of the fact that Spofford had suffered this fate. So, when Mrs. Eddy was away on her memorable trip to Chicago, the Dissident 36, taking advantage of her absence, secured the association books from the secretary's wife, Mrs. William B. Johnson, and turned them over to a lawyer to be held until such time as they should receive letters of honorable discharge. Mrs. Eddy urged them to remain within the fold, writing in a circular letter to them, "At the first special meeting called in behalf of Mrs. Corner, I was absent, not because unready or unwilling to help her, but that she needed no help, and I knew it." Unmoved by this plea, the secessionists clung to the books, justifiably or otherwise, for nearly a year, at which point Mrs. Eddy yielded, granting each a letter of release, no strings attached. Meanwhile, Mrs. Corner was tried in due course and acquitted, expert medical testimony being adduced that the cause of death was such as could not have been averted had a physician been in attendance. But things could not be allowed to slip back into the old rut, where the danger of rebellion stood as a constant threat. The triumph in Chicago, followed within a few short weeks by apparent defeat in Boston, the bewildering contrast presented almost continuously among her followers of utter devotion or bitter rebellion, the silent, ill-concealed struggle everywhere apparent along the age-old lines of which should be greatest, her own seeming helplessness in the presence of open rebellion to settle the issue in any other way but by drastic material action, all these questions evidently began to culminate in a realization that the organization which she had so eagerly and gratefully built up might somehow be at fault. Her college, her church, her association, with all the vision she had had for all three. She did not act hastily, but she determined to get away from Boston, from the struggle and strife which seemed to be everywhere, and give herself time and opportunity to think it all out and see, if possible, what was meant for her to do. Early in 1889, she sent her adopted son, Foster Eddie, Benny as she called him, up into Vermont to look for a place for them to live. A few months previously, she had written to a friend in the country, "Oh, how I want, need, the sweet peace you are enjoying. But when I fall, it must be with my armor on. He girdeth me. He is my shield and buckler. He alone can discharge me from this battle." Now, apparently, it came to her that the kind of stand she was being called upon to make was a much more difficult one than any she had contemplated. On February 15, 1889, she addressed the huge audience at Steinway Hall in New York, already referred to, and had been almost mobbed by overzealous followers and students. Yet here in Boston, the fight still smoldered. She was clearly being required to do something different. And so, on her return from New York, when she got word from Benny that he had found a house for her in the little town of Barre in Vermont, she decided to leave Boston and try to solve her problem in the solitude of the snow-bound countryside. It was a slow and all too bitter process. In spite of all the difficulties with which she had to contend, the year 1888 had been for her one of tremendous activity. Applications for admission to her classes were coming in from all over the country. Between March 1888 and February 1889, she taught nearly 200 students. Among those who went through her classes in this year were many who were later to become well known in the movement, such as General Erastus Bates, Edward A. Kimball, Julia Field King, Lanson P. Norcross, Clara Shannon, Edward P. Bates, James A. Neal, Alfred Farlow, and others. There could be no doubt in her mind but that the movement was going forward, and at a rate she could hardly have thought possible. Evidently, it was just this that was troubling her. Between her disturbing experience in New York on February 15th and her departure for Bar at the end of the month, she taught a class in Boston of over 60 students, and she had before her many applications for admission to future classes. Money was no longer a question. Men and women of wealth and substance were willing and eager to pay anything for her teaching. And although she never deviated from the fee of $300 established years before, save to reduce it or forego it altogether, money seemed now to come to her without effort on her part. This, then, was the picture as she took the train for Bar from the North Station in Boston, the day following the last session of her class. It was to be her last for many years. It was a picture bewildering enough, presenting such glaring contrasts as unity and disaffection, devotion and treachery, outward and visible prosperity past belief, shot through in the most unexpected quarters with conspiracy and unseemly scramble for power, while in and out and over and above it all was an attachment to her own person, whether in love or hate, which evidently cast her into the depths. She found no rest in Bar, and as the long winter gave way to spring, she moved to Concord, New Hampshire, the scene of so much in her early life. It must have been a strange homecoming. Abigail, away over at Sand Button Bridge, now Tilton, had been dead these many years. Her last written words to her sister, words of bitter reproach. The family was scattered, and most of those who had known her were dead or had moved away. She took a house at 62 State Street, and it was here that she reached the strange decision, which appeared to her as the solution to her problem. She would scrap everything and build again from the ground up, and in this new building, she would eliminate the opportunity for personal conflicts as far as possible, and cause the new structure to be founded on principles instead of persons. She does not seem to have seen it all clearly at first. She made one last effort to withdraw herself and yet save her college by appointing Foster Eddy to teach her next class. And when that only gave rise to bitter dissatisfaction, she appointed General Erastus Bates to teach the next one. General Bates was more successful, but the clamor for Mrs. Eddy's own personal instruction continued unabated. And so, sometime in these days, she evidently reached the final decision that the college should be closed, and the church dissolved, and the future progress of the movement left to unorganized voluntary effort and the providence of God. her first step was with the journal. She turned it over completely to the National Christian Scientist Association. And in her 7 fixed rules, which were published in the May issue, she declared emphatically that in the matter of leadership, she desired to turn her followers away from her own personality to the principle of her doctrine. She laid it down, therefore, that she should not in the future be consulted, verbally or through letters, on any question such as the following: as to whose advertisement should be published in the Journal and Christian Science series, on marriage, divorce, or family affairs of any kind, on the choice of pastors for churches, on disaffections, if there should be any, between students of Christian Scientists, on who shall be admitted as members or dropped from the membership of the Christian Science churches or associations, on disease and the treatment of the sick, but I shall love all mankind and work for their welfare. In June, when the National Christian Scientist Association held its annual meeting in Cleveland, the journal was formally handed over to it, and the control vested in the publication committee, which then consisted of Edward P. Bates of Syracuse, New York, Joseph Armstrong of Nebraska, William G. Nixon of Boston, and Augusta Stetson and Caroline D. Noyes of New York. Having thus disposed of the journal, Mrs. Eddy next turned her attention to her college. She hesitated here. When the rumor got abroad, as it did early in the year 1889, after her large class in February, that she really contemplated closing the college, protests from all quarters were so vigorous that, as has been seen, she hesitated and strove to compromise the situation by appointing others to teach in her place. When, in the late summer, it became apparent that this was no solution, she decided to take the drastic step of closing the institution entirely. In a letter of explanation of her action, published in the Boston Traveler, she put the matter simply yet forcibly. "There are," she wrote, 160 applications lying on the desk before me for the primary class in the Massachusetts Metaphysical College. And I cannot do my best work for a class which contains that number." When these were taught, another and a larger number would be in waiting for the same class instruction. And if I should teach that primary class, the other 3 classes, 1 primary and 2 normal, would be delayed. The work is more than one person can well accomplish, and the imperative call is for my exclusive teaching. From the scant history of Jesus and of his disciples, we have no biblical authority for a public institution. This point, however, had not impressed me when I opened my college. "I desire to revise my book, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. And in order to do this, I must stop teaching at present. The work that needs to be done, and which God calls me to outside of college work, if left undone, might hinder the progress of our cause more than my teaching would advance it. Therefore, I leave all for Christ. Later on, in her book Retrospection and Introspection, she suggests how deeply she pondered the question at this time, when she writes, "The apprehension of what has been and must be the final outcome of material organization, which wars with love's spiritual compact, caused me to dread the unprecedented popularity of my college." Her followers, although stunned and not a little dismayed at her action, seem to have apprehended with surprising rapidity, if only dimly at first, what she was seeking to do. When a meeting of the Metaphysical College called for the purpose, assembled on October 29, 1889, the dissolution was effected in a series of resolutions which later became historic. After reciting the purpose and history of the college, its admittedly temporary nature, and the fact that its president at the height of the institution's prosperity was willing to sacrifice it all, if thereby greater spirituality might be gained, the statement continued, "Resolved, that an institution for instruction in Christian science, which is the highest, purest, and noblest of all teaching, should be of a spiritual formation, wholly outside of material regulations, forms, or customs, for which, with other reasons listed, the unanimous vote is that, as all debts of the corporation have been paid, it is deemed best to dissolve this corporation, and the same is hereby dissolved." So the college was closed, and the right by charter to confer degrees permanently surrendered. After the college came the church. Here, in a way, the situation was simple. The dissolution of the material organization did not debar, and was evidently not intended to debar, any voluntary meeting. But in her letter urging dissolution, written from Concord under date November 28, 1889, Mrs. Eddy makes it perfectly clear that if any material organization was to be maintained, it would have to be along far different lines from the one that was being dissolved. And so she wrote, "The Church of Christ Scientist in Boston was my patient 7 years. When I would think she was well nigh healed, a relapse came, and a large portion of her flock would forsake the better portion and betake themselves to the world's various hospitals for the cure of mortal maladies." She was referring, she explained, to those straying sheep who either claimed improvements on her doctrine or disappeared in ignominy. She had put up with this condition of her church for a decade, but must now say, as to a patient who is relapsing because of dependence upon physical hygiene, "Quit your material props and leave all for Christ, spiritual power, and you will recover." If they would agree to drop all material rules whereby to regulate Christ, Christianity, and adopt alone the golden rule for unification, progress and a better example by the simple procedure of disorganizing, she promised to provide them with a plot of ground suitable for the erection of a shining edifice all their own. The deadline was set for their annual meeting to be held December 2, 1889, at which time their decision must be embodied in official action. When the members met at this meeting, they voted to disorganize, and in the next issue of the journal, the whole strange series of incidents was brought to a close in a simple statement by Mrs. Eddy, which sought to emphasize once again the purpose of it all. "The dissolution of the visible organization of the church," she wrote, "is the sequence and complement of that of the college corporation and association. The college disappeared that the Spirit of Christ might have freer course among its students and all who come into the understanding of divine science. The bonds of the church were thrown away so that its members might assemble themselves together to provoke one another to good works, in the bond only of love."